I know that pastors probably aren't supposed to have a favorite gospel, but I confess to you this morning that Luke is my favorite. From the songs and hymns of justice and the birth narrative to Jesus unrolling the scroll in the synagogue and reading from the prophet Isaiah to the story of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, and the Emmaus road that we considered together last week, I feel drawn to the Jesus in Luke's gospel. Again and again, we see the gospel is to bring good news to the poor, release to the captive, sight to the blind, freedom to the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of Jubilee, the forgiveness of all debts. This is no easy gospel, but it's one that I feel compelled to give my life to. With that, I love part two of Luke's gospel as well, the Acts of the Apostles, perhaps called the Acts of Peter and Paul, or more illuminating, the Acts of the Spirit. We find the disciples healing beggars and baptizing eunuchs. Acts is one of the places we're invited to linger with the followers of Jesus after Easter, after resurrection, after their worlds had been turned upside down, or rather right side up. Though it will be a few more weeks before we get to Pentecost, the coming of the Spirit, in our lectionary text, today's story actually takes place after Pentecost. In the passage, we get a brief summary of what life together looks like for these earliest followers of the way. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to the prayers. Awe came upon everyone because many signs and wonders were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with good and generous hearts, praising God and having the good will of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved. What an incredible picture of what it means to actually follow Jesus. But when we sit with this text for a while, we start to get uncomfortable and distance ourselves from it. We want to let ourselves off the hook easy and say, oh, this is a utopian idea. It's not possible. The first century church couldn't even do this or sustain this reality. It's a nice ideal, but realistically, this is not going to happen. And as a preacher, I'm tempted to turn this into a stewardship sermon about giving. Hey, I mean, we need these things, right? It might go something like this. The first followers of Jesus sold everything that they had and gave it to the early church. I'm only asking you to give generously, to tithe, to give 10%. See, isn't that so much easier than this group who shared all things in common? But before we dismiss, repurpose, or wiggle out from under this text, I want us to linger for a little while with this first century band of followers and peer into their context and life. The first followers of Jesus were Jewish, and they were well acquainted with suffering, with slavery, with forcibly being removed from their homeland, with diaspora. They had been awaiting a Messiah that would come and establish God's reign on earth, granting them security and safety once and for all. And when Jesus did come and show up on the scene, he didn't make them more safe. Instead, he was crucified on a Roman cross, executed because he was a threat to the established order. They wanted to run and hide, but the risen Christ kept appearing to them. The Spirit moved among them, and they're left trying to figure out what it means to be followers of this Jesus. Meanwhile, they're living within the Roman Empire, Pax Romana. The empire thinks of itself as good, establishing peace and order, even the world's best hope for order, safety, security, and productivity. Yet the establishment and enforcement of peace comes by controlling, ordering, policing, and building the empire on the backs of slaves. The empire is so convinced that it is right that threats to this peace are to be purged by all means necessary, including violence, including crucifixion of those who threaten this peace. And so I submit to you today that more is happening in this story beyond the sharing of possessions. I don't mean to diminish that in any way. There's more at work here. Radical transformation and radical salvation are taking place. Slave and slaveholder are sitting at the table together, sharing their stories with one another, spending much time together, breaking bread and praying together. These are people who are not supposed to share anything in common. The empire has carefully constructed boundaries to ensure they share nothing in common. And yet, those who have the power of empire on their side and those who are struggling for their own survival are sharing all things in common. To all as any had need. As Jews and Gentiles come together in the book of Acts, a new story is being told. African-American theologian and scholar Willie Jennings, in his new commentary on the book of Acts, writes, "The stories that had been told are now being told differently. And the established storytellers are being challenged. The storytellers are the most powerful people in the book of Acts and in every time and every place." This band of followers share their stories with one another. They share stories of pain and suffering and death, fighting for survival. They share stories of power and loneliness and emptiness. They share stories of hope for a new way of being in the world, a new way of sharing life in the world, a new way of seeing one another in this world. As the Spirit of God moves in their midst, they realize that they have fallen in love with one another. And it's this profound love that transforms their gathering, their community, their history, and their future. The Spirit keeps showing up, paying no attention to the boundaries of empires or nation states, breaking down constructed barriers of race, religion, class, and economics that have separated them for far too long. Jennings continues, "The Spirit is crumbling imperial design from within by destroying the divide between those enslaved and their masters. Hierarchies are being undone. The common is the goal of life together in God. The Spirit at work in the book of Acts portrays the divine fantasy of a creation turned in love and embraced by its creator. The common is the goal of life together in God. A creation turned in love. Is that possible amidst the reality we find ourselves today? Just this last week, we saw another black child gunned down by the police, Jordan Edwards. Just this last week, we learned that the Justice Department is not going to bring civil charges against the officer who killed Alton Sterling. Just this last week, we learned the hate-filled words spewed at Alton Sterling in his last moments of life. Just this last week, on the so-called National Day of Prayer, the House of Representatives passed inhumane revisions to the Health Care Act, while the president released his latest executive order defaming religious liberty, while parading it around as if he had somehow saved it. It feels like we're being separated, segregated more and more with each passing day, rather than being transformed by the common, by life together in the Spirit, by life together in love. And yet, our life together is transforming me. Though we have been here less than 100 days, the stories that you shared about your journeys, your suffering and pain and loss, the places that you found deep joy, the honest, painful, beautiful ways that you're eking out your own humanity, these stories are changing me. These stories are calling me to sanctuary, to justice, to love, not just because of a general, non-specific story, but because of the particular, embodied, in flesh stories about being human that we share. Jennings claims that the storytellers are the most powerful people in every time and place. So I ask you this day, what stories are we telling? Are we telling the truth about our vulnerabilities and struggles? Are we being honest about the stories that have been lorded over our living together for far too long? About who is human, about who is the stranger, about how we are entangled in a narrative of white supremacy that is destroying lives. Are we willing to behold the stories of others, even when we realize our complicity in their pain? Can we hear and bear witness to one another's humanity without trying to fix each other and turn one another into our projects? Might we commit ourselves to making room to behold one another's vulnerability without trampling on one another's souls? Whose stories are we listening to, and whose do we need to get to hear? Several months ago, I came across a compelling story in the Washington Post about a man named Derek Black. Perhaps you read it. He was raised by former Ku Klux Klan leaders and was a child prodigy for the white nationalist movement. He was such a rising star that he was called upon at the age of 19 to offer a keynote speech for former heads of the Ku Klux Klan and prominent neo-Nazis. He was considered to be a brilliant strategist, calling for the mainstreaming of the white nationalist movement by infiltrating the Republican Party. When he went to college, he tried to keep these views to himself, including his radio show and website. even though he would head off campus every morning and phone in to the radio show that he hosted. He happened to hang out and watch movies while he was at school with a Peruvian immigrant and an Orthodox Jew, and he liked them. Eventually, though, a classmate found him out, discovered Derek's views, and posted it to the message board, and he was ostracized by nearly all at the school. So much so that he had to move off campus to avoid the derision. Some of his former friends wrote to tell him just how disappointed they were in him, with less kind words. Eventually, though, a couple of students began discussing how they might engage Derek rather than ostracize him, or simply ostracize him. And they asked one another, "Who's clever enough to change this guy's mind?" Matthew Stevenson, an acquaintance of Derek, said that he had an idea, and he invited Derek to Shabbat dinner one Friday night. Being the only Orthodox Jew on campus, each Friday night, Stevenson would host a Shabbat meal for 8 to 10 people. He told all those gathering that first night that Derek came to treat him like everyone else. They continued to gather on Friday nights for Shabbat meals for over 2 years. And after a few months together, they began asking Derek about his views and would really listen to his answers. They would send him articles to counter his perspective, understanding that the intellectual, scientific arguments were the things that changed his mind. And over time and with real relationships established, Derek examined his views with his friends. Slowly and steadily, his views changed. He disaffiliated completely from white nationalism, and he even apologized for all the pain that he had caused. After reading this article, I found myself thinking about it for days and days on end, about the stories that were shared around that Shabbat table, about the slow transformation that took place at that table. At the table of fellowship, even the most deeply held and damaging views of white supremacy were dislodged. At the table of fellowship, stories were shared and new life together was reimagined. At the table of fellowship, they shared things in common. Friends, today we are invited to the table of fellowship. We are invited to share this meal in common. We're invited to let the divine love of God pursuing us through God's Spirit penetrate our hearts and press us beyond the boundaries that have been constructed for our separation. We're invited to share new stories of God's work in our lives with one another. We're invited to be transformed by the good news of the gospel. May we prepare our hearts and minds to gather at this table of fellowship. Amen.